All right, I'd like to call the Senate Resource Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 15th, 2024. The time is 3:31 p.m. Present today, Senator Klayman, Senator Wilikowski, Vice Chair, Senator Co-Chair Geisel, myself, Bishop, and Senator Kaufman, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kawasaki is excused. And we do have a quorum to do business. Recording Secretary Sopp. Good afternoon, ma'am. Mr. Williams back there behind us. And today's agenda, we're going to take public testimony on SB 164 State Park Permits for Disabled Veterans by Senator Bjorkman. We're going to have a first hearing on SB 175 Electronic Device Recycling by our own Senator Tobin. And first hearing on HB 143 Advanced Recycling and Facilities by House Resources. So with that, I'd like to open up public testimony. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing none online, is there anyone wishing to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. I'd like to set an amendment deadline of Friday, March 25th, 2022 at 5 p.m. for amendments. Again, that's Friday, March 22nd at 5 p.m. for amendments. At this time, we'll take a brief at ease.
I call Senate Resources Committee back to order. The second item on our agenda today is Senate Bill 175, Electronic Device Recycling, by Senator Lukey Tobin. And I would invite Senator Tobin to please come forward and her staff, Louie Flora. Welcome to the committee, Senator Tobin. And I will let you go ahead with your staff and present the bill to us. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lukey Gail Tobin, and I have the pleasure and privilege of representing Senate District I here in this body.
My name is Louie Flora, and I'm staff to Senator Lukey Gail Tobin.
Thank you very much for hearing what I think is a pretty important bill today. Before we get underway with a sectional analysis and with a brief presentation from one of our invited testifiers, please allow me a little bit to tell you about what this bill does. So just a really quick shout out to all of my former classmates who helped me start the UAA Recycling Club, which now is supported by a fee at our illustrious university. And also, I want to send my condolences to the family of the late Gary Smith of Total Reclaim, who let me enjoin him on volunteering for Community E-Waste Recycling Day in exchange for fare tickets, because I was so excited to do that in university. And of course, we have some invited testifiers here. One of them is Anonima Shannon from Cowarick, who let me volunteer with her when I came back from the Peace Corps on some of our e-recycling in the Nome community. And that's what we're talking about today, is e-recycling. So that is the part of Senate Bill 175 that we'll spend most of our time discussing. What is this idea of e-recycling in our communities? Well, the first thing that Senate Bill 175 does is it creates a stable funding stream to help support the ongoing efforts to recycle used electronic devices so that they don't end up in our rural landfills. It does this by authorizing a product stewardship model for electronic device recycling here in the state of Alaska. What is product stewardship, you might ask? Well, it is a system where a manufacturer of an electronic device builds in a cost allocation for retrieving and recycling devices they have produced when they are at the end of their useful life. Why do we need to do this? Why should we recycle electronic waste? Well, there's just millions of human health risks associated with increased lead poisoning as they are used in those ray tubes found in computers and TV screens. Cadmium is used in rechargeable batteries and contacts and switches. And mercury, which we all know is a very terrible, a terrible item once it gets into our water systems because it's used in the liquid crystal displays of mobile phones and flat screen computer monitors, as well as switches, batteries, and fluorescent lamps. These are all components of electronic devices that are currently in the landfills in Alaska. And many of these landfills are unlined. If you are unfamiliar with the different types of landfills here in the state, we can talk a little bit about that, but just know that there are over 184 unlined landfills here in the state of Alaska. And here in our community of Juneau, we have an unlined landfill as well. Many of the unlined landfills in the state were grandfathered in. So the chemicals that are in these electronic devices are leaching out into our water systems right now if they are not part of an electronic recycling program. One of the things we also know happens in landfills across Alaska is the use of fires to reduce the items in those landfills to help consolidate them and make them smaller amounts of waste. Well, just think about lighting all those electronic items on fire and getting all of that cadmium, lead, and mercury into the air, breathing that in as you're a young child trying to learn and grow in those communities. Now, this idea of a product stewardship model is not untested. You're going to hear from our invited testifiers a little bit more about how this has worked in other states, but please know that half of the U.S., including Hawaii and Canada, do use this product stewardship model to recycle their waste. Product stewardship is a cost allocation, which means it becomes part of doing the business. And we've seen in other states, they actually haven't seen an increase in those products, those electronic devices, because it is just the cost of doing business, recycling the product that you're introducing into those communities. One of the things I think is really interesting to note is Dell Technologies, one of the most commonly used manufacturers for electronic devices, recorded a record-breaking year in 2022 of $102 billion. I think they have the money to help get this electronic waste out of our communities. Part of this product stewardship model is to collect, transport, and recycle all of those pieces. Right now, that process of collection, transportating, and recycling is being borne by Alaskan communities, nonprofit organizations, tribes, and businesses in my own hometown of Nome. Kuwerik does much of that work, carrying the brunt of all of that responsibility on their shoulders. Before we get into a sectional analysis of the bill, I do want everyone to know that this bill comes to us and was asked to be asked us to carry it as part of the Alaska Solid Waste Task Force. Stakeholders on that task force included Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, Kuwerik Incorporated, and Zender Environmental. And you'll hear from some of our testifiers from a few of those organizations. In your bill packet, you should have a letter of support from the Alaska Federation of Natives, the Solid Waste Association of North America, as well as letters of support from numerous other communities, organizations, and businesses. If it is the will of the committee, we can provide a sectional analysis before we have a brief presentation.
Sectional analysis would be great.
Sure.
Thank you. It's a long bill.
Yeah. Thank you. Again, my name is Louis Flora. I'm staff to Senator Lukey Tobin. And yes, thank you for the opportunity to go through the sectional, and I'll try and be as brief as possible. But Senate Bill 175, in Section 1, Page 1, we have legislative findings. And this is the legislative findings deal with the potential for antitrust actions, and the legislative legal wanted to have some verbiage in there to add protections. And the reason there might be an antitrust action, it's highly unlikely, and it hasn't happened in other states, but when the manufacturers that are part of this legislation can come together under a clearinghouse, and so they combine their into a single entity. And so my understanding is that is what legislative legal brought forward as protection from antitrust in this intent language. But I also understand that some there's not always a love of intent language in certain legislation. So I wanted to bring that forward. Section 2 amends 29 AS 2910-200 to add regulation of electronic device recycling to the list of restrictions on home rule municipality powers. And then following that, in page two adds a new section, 2935-142, providing that the authority to regulate electronics recycling is reserved by the state. And that's why the section two prohibition restriction on home rule powers is, because this is, would be a state program for economies of scale and just the structure of it. Section four is on page two. It amends AS 4550-572B. And again, this is the dealing with the antitrust actions, and This is a chapter on competitive practices, regulation of competition, consumer protection, which prohibits monopolies, this section does. And this adds the electronic product stewardship program to the list of programs shielded from antitrust actions. Senate Bill 1, and I mentioned that, Senate Bill 175 authorizes multiple companies that manufacturers to combine forces. So that's the concern. Sections 5 through 12 is all conforming language. There's no changes to existing statute. We're just separating the electronics recycling program from the chapter on recycle and reduction of litter, which is currently on the books. Section 13, which is pages 6 through 23, is the meat of the bill, and that's what establishes the electronic product stewardship program. And I'll start with that. Section 4606-200 would be a new section on page 6 and requires manufacturers of the following electronic devices sold in the state to register annually with the state of Alaska. The following devices are computers and small-scale servers, computer monitors, televisions, printers, fax machines, and scanners, digital video disc players, digital video disc recorders, and video cassette recorders, video game consoles, microwave ovens, digital converter boxes, cable receivers, and satellite receivers, and battery-operated portable digital music players, computer keyboards, computer mice, and cables. Section 4606-210, on pages 7 through 10, deals with the manufacturer e-scrap program plans, and it states the manufacturer and delineates the manufacturer and manufacturer clearinghouse responsibilities. In this section, manufacturers of electronic devices shall submit an annual plan to the Electronics Recycling Advisory Council, which is established later in the bill. They submit the plan for feedback and incorporate this feedback from the advisory council into a plan then submitted to the Department of Environmental Conservation. And plans must include contact information, a description of the methods used in achieving the recycling program, audit and accounting information, and timelines for implementation. The manufacturer shall assume all costs of implementing the plan. If two or more manufacturers are participating in a manufacturer clearinghouse, the clearinghouse shall assume all costs and manufacturers shall pay a proportional share based on national sales over the past 2 years. Section 4606-220 on pages 10 through 12 establishes the requirements for community electronic device collection sites, including the frequency of collection events and collector responsibilities. Section 4606-230 on page 12 and 13 pertains to the department responsibilities. In this section, DEC shall review and approve or disapprove electronic recycling plans and annual reports, conduct periodic studies to determine if new devices should be added to the recycling program, report to the legislature every 2 years after 2030 on the effectiveness of the program. DEC shall write regulations to establish the amount and manner of payment of a program administration fee for manufacturers and manufacturer clearinghouses covered under the Act. DEC may also adopt further regulations for the implementation and enforcement of the program. On section 4606-240 on page 14, we have outreach requirements for manufacturers of electronic devices participating in recycling programs established by this Act, and for DEC and for retailers of electronic devices and for communities. Sections 4606-250 on pages 14 and 15 are the prohibited acts section. Under this section, a person may not knowingly mix electronic waste covered under this act with landfill waste, may not knowingly burn electronic waste. A retailer may not sell devices covered under this act unless they are labeled and branded. A manufacturer may not provide electronic devices covered under this act unless it is labeled and branded. An electronic recycling program may not charge fees for collection. Last page on section 4606-260, page 15. Sorry, last page of the sectional analysis. Page 15 of the bill establishes penalties for false statements, submitting falsified reports, and failure to pay registration fees. The new section 4606-270 on pages 16 and 17 is where we have the advisory Electronics Recycling Advisory Council, appointed by the Commissioner of DEC to serve two-year terms. The purpose of the council is to review and comment on proposed manufacturer e-scrap program plans before submission of the plan to the department. They also make recommendations to the department regarding the approval or disapproval of a plan. They make recommendations to the department regarding the need for plan amendments or other requirements based on annual reports. And they review and comment on regulations proposed by the department under AS 4606-230, and by November 1st of each year, beginning in 2026, provide to the department a list of best practices for program collection sites and single-day collection events under the manufacturer e-scrap program plans. Section 4606-280 on page 18, it describes those electronic devices that are not subject to the terms of the Act. Section 4606-290 on pages 19 through 23 is the definition section. On section 14, we have a transition section regarding the advisory council seats, where the commissioner shall appoint 7 initial members of the council to serve 4-year terms and the remaining 6 initial members to serve 3-year terms. Initial members may be reappointed to subsequent 2-year terms thereafter. And finally, section 15 is an immediate effective date. And that's the end.
Very good. Thank you. Committee members, any questions? Yes, Senator Klayman.
The section we just heard about the members of the board, 13 members seems like a lot. Why go with so many as opposed to, I understand the importance of public participation, but 13 seems pretty big.
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, and I don't have the bill, I should open the page of the bill, but my understanding is because of the Solid Waste Alaska Task Force work, where they have identified numerous stakeholders in the process, they wanted to mirror that in the advisory body, but the number of seats could be discussed. I would also defer to our invited testifiers on what the importance of that number is.
Very good. We can ask for input from invited testimony. Anything further, Senator Klayman? Yes, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, when I heard the immediate effective date, I'm still trying to, and will be for a while, absorbing all the things that are going on here. And with an immediate effective date, the first thing that pops up is, will people be ready to be in compliance should this have an immediate effective date?
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Through the chair, for the record, Lukey Tobin, Senator for Senate District I. The immediate effective date is to help start propagating the regulation. The actual program does not go into effect. I believe it's 2029 is the actual date. So it gives it some time to stand up and to start working with community partners and also for those plans to be propagated.
Missed that, so thank you.
All right, I see no further questions. And so you have some invited testimony, Senator Tobin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Lukey Tobin, Senator for Senate District I. First up, we have Leland Rayhard, who is from the Product Stewardship Council and will be providing a brief presentation. And if it works for the committee, we'll stay here and advance the slides.
That sounds great. So, Leland?
Yes, can you hear me
there
okay?
There on Teams, great. Well, welcome, sir. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Leland Rehard. I am a policy and programs manager for the Product Institute. And please interrupt me if you have trouble hearing me or have any questions. I think I'm ready for the next slide. Louis, thank you. A little bit about who we are. The Product Stewardship Institute is a national not-for-profit that has been around for about 23 years. We have members of state and local governments across the country. They also make up our board and help us determine our direction. And our goal is to help propagate and support the types of policies that you're seeing here today. We also have partners in the industry, with international governments and with a lot of other folks to help us better inform the bills and programs that we bring forward. Next slide, please. a little bit about the type of program you've just, you know, heard the sectional analysis for. It can go under different names. We call it Extended Producer Responsibility, or EPR. It can also be called Product Stewardship. But in a nutshell, what it does is it extends a producer or manufacturer's responsibility for their products, not just to the product design or to their consumer, but all the way down the line to reuse, recycling, and safe disposal, both for them to have a financial and managerial stake in the recycling and reuse of their products at end of life. This is not a new concept. It's been the policy that has helped fund waste and recycling in Europe, Canada, and many other countries for many decades now. Next slide, please. It is also prevalent here in the United States and growing. In 2000, when we first started, there were 8 product stewardship laws for 1 product, batteries, in 7 states. Iowa had 2 laws. Next slide, please. But today, as of 2024, and the start of this legislative session, there are 136 laws in the United States covering 18 different types of product categories in 33 states. That's about 260 million people in America who live in a state with a product stewardship law or program. Next slide, please. These laws have been growing since 2000, frequently, and are starting to grow exponentially now. And I expect that 136 number to be higher next year when I do a similar presentation. It is becoming the policy for managing difficult waste, or waste that people want to see out of the landfill and recycled. Next slide, please. It's also been used to manage waste of several different product categories. I mentioned 18 product categories, everything from batteries, pharmaceuticals, to now with 4 states in the United States doing packaging. That's your can, bottle, piece of paper, you know, what you traditionally recycle being covered in these programs in 4 states in the U.S., and more states will add that as well. Next slide, please. These laws, and one of those product categories, and one of the oldest product stewardship laws in the U.S. is electronics. There are currently 23 states and the District of Columbia that have some form of a product stewardship law and program for managing electronics. Now, these programs vary. Some states, the programs are very robust, like Oregon, Washington, New Jersey, Minnesota. And in some states, the programs are not well set up and older. For example, my home state where I'm sitting right now in Missouri has a program I would not recommend or bring forward to Alaska or to any new state. Next slide, please. So these programs, you know, I get the pleasure of working on them all the time, working with states often who have had many EPR or product stewardship programs, and they are kind of confusing. It's a very different way of thinking about managing waste and recycling. So I just kind of want to break it down here, kind of in a nutshell, how a program can work. A law can be passed, like the one that we are seeing here, SB 175. Once that law passes, as Senator Tobin said, there is a fairly lengthy time frame for it to be implemented. And in that time, manufacturers or producers would register with the department and join. Here at Louis has called it a clearinghouse or a coordinating body. The name varies from state to state. Typically in Europe and other places, they're called a producer responsibility organization, or PRO. This is an organization that specializes in implementing these types of laws and programs on behalf of manufacturers. It's very rare for just one manufacturer like Dell, for example, to come in, submit a plan. We're only going to collect our Dell computers. They typically pool together underneath one of these organizations to implement this. Once they've joined a PRO, that organization goes around developing a plan for how they're going to accomplish the intent that is laid forth in the law by talking to communities, talking to folks who do transportation and logistics, and figuring out how they can put forward a plan for DEC, and in this case, an advisory council, to consider and eventually approve. The funding for that plan is laid out in this law. It comes from manufacturers or producers of the devices that are covered under the law, and that obligation is broken up by market share. Typically, it's broken up by U.S. market share. So if I'm Samsung and I make 10% of the TVs that are being sold in the United States, I have a 10% obligation into the cost or what it takes to recycle TVs in this program. It's typically how they're broken down in other states. Once the funding's coming in, the PRO implements the program by working with local infrastructure, which includes reaching out to communities, reaching out to the various transportation and logistics companies to make sure that the material is moved around appropriately, and setting up contracts with recyclers that ensure that that material is properly recycled and that it is managed in a way that meets the standards, usually of the industry itself, but also of the state. And the last piece is a kind of a continuation of showing that the program is working by providing regular reports, typically annual, to DEC, and in this case, to the Advisory Council, to show that the program is meeting its goals, what changes they're making, how they're doing outreach, and how they're meeting the intent of the law. Last slide, please. So with that, that ends my part of the presentation. You'll hear from some folks who worked very intimately with making this possible and bringing this forward to you, but happy to pause here and take any questions you may have.
Thank you for your presentation. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rehard, for your presentation. Are you sort of familiar enough with SB 175 particularly to sort of comment on specifics of this legislation, or are you just speaking generally about these programs?
No, I'd be happy to talk about specifics as best I can. And if I don't have the answer instantly, I might ask if I could follow up later with the list of questions. But no, I'm happy to answer questions specifically about the bill.
Wonderful. Thank you. I think having spoken with the sponsor and read through some of these materials, I think I have some sense of the core of the bill, which is, as you're describing, sort of this allocation of costs and setting up new recycling programs and working with the manufacturers. What I didn't realize was in the bill, and it's a relatively large bill, and so I'm still learning about it, is Section 4606250 and Section 260, which is prohibited acts and penalties. So for individuals, so I thought it was more having to do with corporations and companies that were involved in this, but I think it's individuals, that they, if they, let's say I've got a working class person and living in East Anchorage, they've got an old TV, and they throw it in the dumpster outside their fourplex. As I read this here, they could be fined up to $10,000. Now, I don't think that would actually happen realistically. There's language in there about the amount of penalty shall be adjusted for a serious of the violation. But that's a pretty significant hammer. I mean, making these new prohibited acts and then potentially large penalties for individuals, right? And so I guess my question is this how it's being done in other states, and how is it being applied? I mean, is this standard that you have these very large fines, not for corporate polluters, but for individual people?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And kind of the heart of it is what we typically call in policies a landfill ban. So if you're going to set up a program that creates robust recycling infrastructure, the incentive to make sure folks use it is to ban it from the landfill. Not every state uses that approach. And some states have these programs with no landfill bans. In regards to the specific fees, I'm guessing it probably mirrors illegal dumping fees and other fee structures that may already exist in Alaska's statute. We typically don't recommend what those fees or what those penalties should be and leave it to states to choose what's appropriate, what enforcement works for them, and what fee structures they have. So I don't think that this committee, when they were going through it, specified an exact fee structure or, how that is typically handled. They did, when we were going through it, think that having some sort of landfill ban would be needed to make sure that the program was working as best as it can. That's typically a state-by-state kind of decision. One state that's famous for landfill bans is Massachusetts. And another state that is famous for having great recycling programs but very few landfill bans would be Washington. So it can vary from state to state. This is just what the stakeholders hear when reviewing the program, going through it step-by-step, and we bring forward, okay, it's time to talk about landfill bans. Here are the pros, here are the cons, here's what can work in different states. And that was a discussion that occurred to have this input in this bill. As far as a precise fee structure and how Alaska DEC, what their philosophy is for enforcement, I think you've kind of described it in your own experience that it does not instantly go to the highest penalty. I would leave that question and determination to them. I'm sorry, does that answer the question? I apologize if I need to do any follow-up.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar?
Just briefly, that largely answers my question. I appreciate it. I guess I'd like to see if any evidence exists, if you could supply it, a state like Massachusetts, states with landfill bans, how and when and how often is it actually applied? The enforcement for, technically we would probably have people in Anchorage violating this, that kind of ban, you probably have dozens, if not hundreds, of instances a day, right? And so I'd be curious to see how that, you know, somebody throws away a Game Boy from the early 90s, right? And they have violated this, right? People clearing out an old house, you know, and there's going to be some electronics that find their way into the landfill. So I'm curious how that stuff is enforced. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, typically it is not enforced on the individual. It's rarely enforced at a penalty level that I'm aware of with all the state departments that I work with. Typically, it's at the landfill. If the inspector notices a whole bunch of electronics coming out of a trash truck, for example, they might ask that, you know, that trash hauler to provide information or outreach to their customers about what can and can't be put in the trash. I'm personally not aware of any individual being fined for putting something in a landfill, because usually whenever you pull up to a landfill, there might be someone right there at the open face. Now, it could be very different here in Alaska as far as who has access to dumping those. And that's certainly something that may need to be considered about, you know, the reasonableness of fees or a landfill ban in this state.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Lukey Tobin, Senator for Senate District I. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I do want to recommend looking at page 14. Where under that section of statute about outreach requirements, there are substantial requirements in this bill to ensure that folks are aware of any penalties that they may incur if they were to violate the stipulations of the legislation. Additionally, I think some of our invited testifiers can also talk about some of the practices that are happening across rural Alaska, where you may not necessarily have as managed facilities as you have in Anchorage, where there are folks who will help to provide that input and insight and maybe help remove some of those items if they do show up at, say, central transfer station from those spaces. In some of our more rural communities, folks will just drive their four-wheeler out and drop these materials into those unmanned and unmanaged landfills. And I think this is really trying to get some teeth so that we can help deter that practice. But that isn't necessarily the intent of the bill. The intent of the bill is to provide that education and ensure folks understand what the infringements would incur if they were to violate this electronic recycling program.
Further questions, Senator Dunbar?
One follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you, Senator Tobin. And, you know, I my mom used to run the recycling program at the Cordova Baylor, so I'm familiar with some of the, and of course we live in Eagle where you just went to the side of a hill and dumped everything over the side of the hill back in the 80s. But I guess it does also, that raises another equity question, which I think your next testifier will probably get into, which is, we can't enforce these kind of bans in small towns where we don't have the program set up, right? So if there is any issue where we'd have this huge equity problem where you'd have people out in rural Alaska that, you know, they themselves probably can't afford to get this item realistically to a recycling site. And so, you know, what are they going to do? They're probably going to go to the dump, and that's not ideal, but I don't think your intent is to fine that person, right?
Again, Lukey Tobin for the record. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, correct. And I think Anama Shannon can talk pretty eloquently about how she works with all the small communities around the Nome hub to collect those materials and then move them to the hub at designated dates and the support and the services that they provide.
So going on with questions for Mr. Rehard, Senator Kaufman.
Through the chair to Mr. Rehard, do you have any, or have you considered, I think of it as the wag the dog syndrome. We're a small market here, and sometimes when we try and exert leverage, we're doing it with a population that wouldn't make a big city in the lower 48, and we're very remote with respect to supply chains. Is there any risk that we put something in the statute and, you know, the couple days before the Super Bowl, Costco says it's not going to sell any TVs because there's some recycling fee that isn't quite yet rolled. I'm making up the situation, but a concern around that, just considering the specific small and remote market that Alaska represents.
No, I think you raise a valid concern. I know that, you know, that I don't want to say it's a threat, but that point has been made, for example, in Hawaii, which does have an electronics EPR program. Not maybe as robust as the one that's being presented here today, but that was certainly a consideration there. And I'm not aware of a producer not supplying their product currently to Hawaii because of that program. These programs, while they vary in their funding, they do support other states with small marketplaces as well. One advantage of being a small marketplace, even with the logistical concerns that you have, is that it could also be about the same cost as serving a lower 48 program, considering the frequency with which the waste may actually be accumulated. So I've heard those, it's hard to call them threats, but maybe considerations that manufacturers might make. We have never seen that take place or happen in other jurisdictions like Hawaii, for example. I think it is also worth noting, as Senator Tobin mentioned, that the cost of these programs amount to a very small cost relative to the industry itself. I mentioned, I believe, one of the questions about the program costs was one example of how much these programs cost in the states. Washington states cost about $4 to $5 million a year. That comes out to, you know, about 35 cents per pound collected each year through the program. And just for kind of a comparison, I believe the retail sales revenue for electronics for the products covering this program was about $500 billion last year. So it's a relatively small cost in the whole scheme of things. They'll still say it's a high cost, of course. I mean, it's their business. That's their right to do that. But I have not seen an actual producer not sell their product, especially since we're obligating larger manufacturers. There is a stipulation in there if you're an extremely small company that you're not obligated to pay into this. There's kind of a threshold for manufacturers that are obligated as well. So it wouldn't be if you had a small startup business in Alaska that was producing some kind of covered entity, it most likely would not be burdened by this program.
Follow up, Senator Kaufman?
No, thanks. I'll hold off for now.
Senator Klayman?
A little bit on the same theme for Mr. Richard. If we effectively, what we're doing is we're asking that the cost be included in the sale price when the electronics first sell. Have any of the states that have implemented these laws seen any meaningful change in sales because of the additional cost that is essentially built into the sale price?
No, is the short answer, unless they pursue a consumer fee. California's program, for example, is actually a fee placed at point of sale, and then those monies go to the state to do their program. It's a very different model than what we're proposing here in Alaska. That one is a direct increase in cost. But no, for the other programs, there's no discernible cost that could be attributed to this program. If I got on Amazon and I bought a TV in Oregon versus Idaho, there's no difference in cost based on this program. There's also been studies, not necessarily on electronics, but on the packaging programs. So these are the programs that are much larger, and they fund, you know, entire countries' recycling systems pretty much. And we'll soon fund Colorado, California, Maine, and Oregon's recycling systems as well. And then those studies, there's no discernible cost for running that program on consumer goods that cannot just be attributed to inflation or sales tax or other means for which goods prices increase. Does that help answer the question?
Senator Klayman?
Just a very short follow-up. So you're describing the California program that if I bought a computer in California, in addition to paying whatever the sales tax is, there'd be a fee of some amount that I would pay directly that would be added on top of the sales tax to the final price I paid at the time.
Yeah, I believe they only charge it for TVs and monitors. I don't think it's what you typically buy with a computer, so it probably does get tacked onto that too. And their rates are posted on their website. They get updated occasionally. It's not obligating the manufacturers. It is pretty much just a consumer fee, which, of course, is not the type of program that we would propose or ask for out of the state.
All right. I see no further questions, Mr. Rayard. Thank you very much for joining us. Next up under invited testimony is Riley Kosinski with the Waste Logistics and Training Development Specialist.
Oh, Madam
yeah,
Chair,
go ahead.
My name is Anama Shannon, and I will actually testify next.
Oh, all right.
Sorry.
So let me, it's Ananhama. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce it, but your last name is Shannon, Environmental Director at Quark. Welcome.
Yes.
Please introduce
Thank
yourself
you.
For the record and give us your testimony.
Okay. Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Anama Shannon. I live in Nome, and I work for Kowarik Incorporated, our native nonprofit here for the Bering Strait region. So on the next slide, I believe, I can't really see your screen, but I think if you have it pulled up, it is a picture of various village landfills.
Yes, it is.
And okay, great. For the past 15 years at Kowarik, our program has been we've implemented a strategy for small villages to be able to get their household hazardous materials out of the village into Nome. We repackage it and we send it to Seattle for proper recycling. And the reason that we do this is because, as Senator Tobin mentioned before, these small rural landfills, as many of you know, are unlined. They burn trash every day to reduce the mass of trash. And therefore, all the dioxins and toxins from this trash gets into the environment in various ways. It gets into the air when they burn. It gets into the water table. People, if they're walking in the landfill to take their trash there, they get it on the bottoms of their shoes and they bring it back home. So for us, it's really important to keep our environment clean, not only, not only for the land, but because we harvest and do subsistence practices year round off that land. And so it directly affects human health. In this picture here, you can see, this is a really realistic view of what it's like in some village landfills. The majority of them have major issues with solid waste management. Typically, it's, it's free to take your stuff there. Nobody is operating equipment or managing the landfill. It's really just a dump. And, somebody will go out there and light a fire to try to get the majority of the trash away. But as you can see in the lower right-hand picture, you can see the proximity from the village to the landfill. It's very close. And when you're burning trash, all that smoke goes up in the air and, people can smell it in their homes. Sometimes they're close to schools. And human health is greatly being affected by the state of these landfills. Clearly, they're going to continue to take trash. But if we can take the most toxic trash out of there, like electronic waste that has heavy, heavy plastic, it has all these heavy metals that Senator Tobin mentioned earlier. If we can get those out of the environment and keep them from getting burned, we're going to be helping human health a lot just by that simple act. And as Leland mentioned earlier, if we can find success with this bill, we can expand to other products in the future. Next slide, please. So this next slide shows the proximity from a landfill to a playground and a school. This is, this is not just a one-time thing. This happens in probably the majority of very small places because the footprint of the whole community is very small. Also, in the winter time, people have to access the landfill. So oftentimes that landfill has to be closed just so that people can take the trash out there and they can keep the road plowed. In the bottom picture on that slide, you can see an actual burned computer and that all that heavy, heavy plastic. It takes a lot of heat for that to burn. And it creates a lot of dioxins, which of course are cancer causing. In 2014, about 10 of us came together, 10 of us professionals came together to create the Solid Waste Alaska Task Force, or SWAT team, as we like to call it. And our first initiative was Backhaul Alaska. It's a program that takes electronics and lead acid batteries and fluorescent bulbs, and we backhaul it or haul it back to Seattle or other locations where it can be properly recycled. So that was our first initiative that we're still working on. And what we have been very well supported by industry and by the federal government. But what we learned through a series of meetings and involving lots of different sectors like the transportation, the recycling, the finance sectors, like we took all of these people, went through a series of meetings and tried to figure out how can we come up with a way to make this sustainable? How can we sustainably keep taking these things out? Because, of course, people keep buying these products. And what we realized is that there's this amazing thing called product stewardship. And that this idea is to share the burden of the cost with industry that is creating these products, thereby holding them accountable to making products that last longer and aren't as disposable, because they have to share a burden of that cost along with consumers, along with everybody else, the federal government, the state. And so we started learning about product stewardship, I believe, in 2017. And we went to see several different places and how they've implemented product stewardship. We went to Victoria, British Columbia, and they have an incredible system. And we got to talk to lawmakers there and understand more about what the benefits are. So we've really been studying up on this. This we feel could be a long-term sustainable solution to helping Alaskans maintain a clean environment and stay healthy and to be able to recycle and get these products out of our communities where they really just don't belong in landfills. And the last slide for me, the next one, again, my program, I'm representing more of the boots on the ground. I'm not the bill expert here, but after running this program at Coweric for the past 15 years, I can say the shipping is really expensive. Sometimes to send a Connex full of material from Nome to Seattle, it can sometimes be as much as $7,000 just for the shipment. And that's just from Nome. So getting it from the villages into the hubs and then on to Seattle, it would be great to be able to have a program that had better infrastructure, was available to across the state, and that we could implement in other places. Economies of scale, as you know, it's a challenge. And this bill would help make it to where small communities that sometimes struggle with, just being able to be proactive, it would enable them to have more robust programs and able to keep their environment and people safe and healthy. I'm not an expert on the bill, but I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your presentation, Ms. Shannon. Any questions for Ms. Shannon from committee members? All right, I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much. We'll go on then to Riley Kosinski. Great. Welcome, Mr. Kosinski.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Riley Kosinski. I live in Haines, Alaska, and I work for Zender Environmental. We're a 501c3 nonprofit based in Anchorage, and we provide training and technical assistance to rural communities on solid waste matters. I'm also a member of the Solid Waste Alaska Task Force, and my main job role is I'm a statewide coordinator for the Backhaul Alaska program that Anama mentioned. And, in short, the program is looking to ultimately set up a framework statewide where any community can effectively and affordably ship out hard-to-manage materials and divert them from their landfill. And one of those materials that we target, we can go forward one slide, I think. I'm trying to look at your screen there, Louis. Oh, no, you were right. One of those materials that our program focuses on is the e-waste. That's what we're looking at here with this bill. And, why e-waste? In short, it's visible, it's bulky, and it's comprised of materials that's potentially harmful to human health and the environment if we improperly dispose of it or if we burn of it, as we heard. And as was mentioned prior, the majority of rural communities have class 3 landfills. They're unlined, and burning is a common waste management practice to reduce volume. And in my experience, I've been in this field, with Zender and other organizations for the last 17 years. But, people in general understand the inherent risks of e-waste. They don't want to burn it. They don't want to put it in their landfill. They want to recycle it. And there's been a lot of good groundwork laid out for the, over the last 15, 20 years to help people do just that. But again, the challenge is the expense. People do a good job of segregating the material, getting it ready for backhaul and in recycling. But, you know, there's a lot of individual efforts. There's group efforts through programs like ours and others. But there's just no sustainable, secure funding source to allow these regular shipments to go out year after year statewide. And what's this bill would do is, essentially, it would ensure that even the smallest and the most remote communities in our state would receive the basic resources needed to ship out these end-of-life electronics consistently and long-term. So on the next slide, and it took years of engagement with many stakeholders. A lot of them are on the screen you see there to get to the point where we are now. Lots of people provided input in various stages of this process. And as was mentioned, both AFN and SWANA, the Solid Waste Association of North America's Alaska chapter, both passed resolutions in support of product stewardship for managing e-waste. And on the next slide, we can see just some of the benefits listed out. But I mean, really, ultimately, this bill would provide a long-term funding source so folks in rural and urban areas alike can divert e-waste from the waste stream. They can get it recycled. We can get these materials back into the circular economy and keep it out of our landfills. And, you know, as Leland mentioned, product stewardship for e-waste that already exists in almost half the states in the nation. There's product stewardship for a variety of other materials and, you know, in even more states. And I've lived here my whole life, and I always get a little jealous because it seems like Alaska gets cut out from a lot of these opportunities and services that folks in the lower 48 get to enjoy. And I mean, I realize we're unique. We have small communities, remote communities, challenging logistics, not many roads. But, you know, in this case, I feel like our state is unique in that we're the state that could benefit or stands to benefit the most from any sort of product stewardship program, you know, and especially for the folks out in rural Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kosinski, for your presentation. Any questions? I see none from the committee. Thank you very much. That concludes our invited testimony. I'm going to open public testimony now. We have Simone Sabalo, I think that may be close, on Teams, and she is the Deputy Director of Zender Environmental Health and Research Group. Ms. Sabalo?
Hi, yes, and I'm sorry my camera is not on. It doesn't work on Teams. It does on Zoom, but not on Teams for some reason. And yes, I'm not providing any specific testimony today. I also am a Solid Waste Alaska Task Force member, and I work alongside Riley with the Backhaul Alaska program and have been working on product stewardship over many years, since 2017, as Anama mentioned, and I'm just here for support and to help answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you for that. So that ends our invited testimony. I will close public testimony now, though we can certainly open it again later. Senator Tobin, do you have any closing remarks today before we set the bill aside?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Again, Luki Tobin, Senator for Senate District I. Thank you for hearing this legislation. I do just want to make a few quick observations after today's testimony. You know, I think one of the questions was why so many folks on the advisory council? And I think we saw a pretty comparable list of all the folks who've been invested in developing this proposal that has come before us. And I know that they have vested interests, and with that many partners who want to have a seat at the table and have input in, I think it's important to ensure that many hands make light work and to keep folks engaged. I also think that this bill is about supporting the actions that are already happening in these communities. We have seen that there is already quite a bit happening to remove these terrible chemicals from our unmanaged and unlined landfills, And this is a practice, a proven way to help support those efforts. And finally, I think the most important piece of all of this is that everyone deserves to live in a healthy community. And here is a way that we can ensure that is possible. So thank you so much for the consideration of this legislation. My office is available for any questions. Louis has become an expert in e-scrap programs, so please come and visit us anytime and ask us for all the things.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Any questions for Senator Tobin? I'll just tell you thank you for this bill. One of the organizations on your list there, I actually have taken computers to. I've had to pay to have them recycled, which I was happy to do, frankly, because I could not bring myself to throw it over the edge at the transfer station. These materials pollute the environment and affect people's health. And I applaud you for finding a solution here. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll set this bill aside. The next bill up today is House Bill 143, Advanced Recycling and Facilities. This is by the House Resources Committee. This is the first hearing of the bill, and I welcome Representative Tom McKay from District 15 to come forward, and Trevor Jepson, who is his staff. And I will welcome you and let you present the bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And looks like it's recycling day here at Senate Resources. My name is Tom McKay, and I represent House District 15, which is Bayshore, Campbell Lake, and Sand Lake, part of Anchorage. And it's our privilege today to be before you and present House Bill 143, entitled Advanced Recycling. So I'll read the sponsor statement, and then my staffer will go through the presentation. So in today's world, there is a heavy push for low greenhouse gas processes for energy, fuel, and petroleum-related products. However, many of the options available to us are not economical without heavy government subsidies, or they simply don't work on a commercial scale. Advanced recycling is a process that defies those trends while also decreasing the amount of plastic that ends up in landfills and in the environment as pollution. House Bill 143 puts into place a regulatory framework that would allow Alaska to participate in the advanced recycling industry, which would create jobs, revenue, and economic activity for the state. Roughly 90% of the plastics that are recycled or sorted at landfills are not suitable for traditional mechanical recycling. Through chemical processes such as pyrolysis and gasification, advanced recycling offers a way to solve this issue by taking plastics which cannot be recycled via traditional methods and converting them into new high-value plastics, chemicals, and other products. 24 other states have passed legislation similar to HB 143 in a bipartisan fashion. I encourage you to support this legislation, which encourages technological innovation, could create new manufacturing jobs, and promotes low greenhouse gas products in an economically viable manner. So with that, I'll turn it over to Trevor Jepson, my staffer, to go through the presentation.
Thank you, Representative McKay.
Thank you.
Mr. Jepson.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. To Representative McKay. Thank you, Co-Chair Giesel and the rest of the Senate Resource Committee members for being here today to hear this bill presentation, which will be on House Bill 143, which puts into statute a regulatory framework which would allow the fledgling industry of advanced recycling to potentially come to our state. Advanced recycling, also referred to as chemical recycling, is a relatively new technology as a commercial industry that's been around for about 10 years, with a recent push for large-scale commercialization in the past 5 years, roughly. There's multiple reasons as to why we're seeing growth in the industry, including more research and analysis refining the technology, and of course the passage of legislation similar to HB 143 in now 24 other states, leading to regulatory stability, with the result being billions of dollars flowing into the domestic advanced recycling industry. This technology can convert post-use plastics that are currently unable to be recycled mechanically into hydrocarbon-based products, bypassing the need to distill the overwhelming amount of our plastic products from crude oil, while also decreasing the amount of plastic that ends up in landfills and the environment. Using advanced recycling, we can convert plastics into valuable products, such as the building blocks for new chemicals, feedstocks for new plastic, plastic additives, waxes, lubricants, and fuels. Although with the caveat that the industry is currently shifting away from fuels being one of the primary products and shifting more towards plastic feedstocks being the primary product. So the majority of the product today is from the industry's naphtha, which is a precursor for the raw materials for plastics. It's important to note that this industry is not dependent on government subsidies and is economically viable without them. And also that advanced recycling is meant to complement, not replace mechanical recycling. We have a circular flow chart here, kind of showing how advanced recycling would be integrated into the recycling industry. If you look at the bottom where that post-use collection is, you see that the arrow up is mechanical recycling and then creation of consumer goods. But currently, there's less than 10% of plastic is able to go that route. So by implementing advanced recycling, we would have another avenue to divert some of that plastic from landfills and back into the economy as plastic feedstock. Next, we'll go into the process that advanced recycling uses, which are also defined as terms in this bill. There is a multitude of chemical and thermochemical processes which can break plastic polymers down into the different hydrocarbon-based products mentioned in the previous slide. These processes include gasification, pyrolysis, and solvolysis. We'll go over the definition of those terms on the next slide, but the important thing to take away here is that all three of these processes are non-combustive. So you shouldn't be thinking of an advanced recycling facility as an incinerator facility because there's no combustion occurring. Of course, there are emissions associated with advanced recycling facilities, and they can be well regulated and subject to federal legislation such as the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. So they can be controlled through technological and operational practices, just like any other type of manufacturing plant. So as mentioned in the previous slide, those three terms, we'll go over them here. The first is gasification, which uses high levels of heat in an oxygen-deficient environment to prevent combustion. And the primary products when advanced recycling is done through gasification is syngas, which is a mixture of carbon monoxide, hydrogen, and methane. Pyrolysis, which is the primary process used in the industry today, uses heat in an oxygen-free environment, and the primary products are base chemicals, in hydrocarbon liquids such as diesel and naphtha. Finally, solvolysis uses solvents and sometimes heat to break down plastic into purified polymers. We're going to go over pyrolysis a little bit more in depth. As I mentioned, that is the primary process used in the industry today. So in this flow chart, we have illustrated the advanced recycling process and how that would look in the market. So if you start in the bottom left-hand corner at the end-use/consumers, that plastic would be sent to a sorting and cleaning facility, at which point in time the plastic would then be sent to an advanced recycling facility, which would run the plastic through their manufacturing process of pyrolysis, which would create naphtha. And those volumes of naphtha would then be sent to cracker or plastic resin producers, where they would turn the naphtha into plastics, which would then be put back into the market via for packaging, manufacturing, etc. So it's estimated that as little as 9% of plastics that are recycled in the U.S. are actually reused. This number doesn't fully account for the amount of plastic that's thrown away and that ends up in the environment as pollution, so it's highly likely the number is much lower than that. And the number is expected to drop even further as we continue to produce plastic in the coming decades with no capacity to recycle it mechanically. Countries that we used to ship plastic to for recycling purposes, such as China, are no longer taking our trash. The result being that landfills are filling up faster than ever, and we expect that trend to exacerbate unless something else is done. Advanced recycling can be a key part of that solution. This was also mentioned in the last presentation, but advanced recycling fits into what's known as the circular economy, where through policy and technology, we can incentivize markets to reuse products on a scale not seen in our current society, which can allow waste to be more efficiently or used or returned to the economy as valuable products. Here we have an economic model with a summary of the potential economic benefits associated with an advanced recycling facility. Since models are only as good as your assumptions, first, we'll go over what those are for the purposes of this model. So for this model, we assumed one advanced recycling facility in the state and roughly 60,000 metric tons of landfill plastic, with 50% of that being available for advanced recycling. The total landfill plastic state data was estimated based on our state's population share of total U.S. population based on the 2020 census, with a weighting factor applied to account for the estimated recycling rate of the state. The economic modeling software used for this particular model is called Implan. So we see a direct effect in employment of 100 jobs, a payroll of 10.4 million, and an economic output of 34.2 million. In addition to the direct impacts, we see downstream employment, both direct and induced, of another 150 jobs. Similarly, we see additional payroll of $10.5 million and additional output of $36 million. Those induced jobs are value stemming from household spending off income after taxes and savings. And the indirect outputs are business-to-business purchases in the supply chain taking place in a region that stem from the initial industry input purchases. And if there are any questions on the economic model, I believe we have Adam Peer from the American Chemistry Council online. Yeah.
Yes, he is online, and we can certainly have him speak after you finish this PowerPoint. Thank you.
So why should Alaska and the legislature as a whole want to bring advanced recycling to Alaska? First, advanced recycling is a low greenhouse gas process that can be used to produce petroleum-based products. It would greatly increase the percentage of plastics that can be recycled, decrease landfill taken up by plastics, landfill space taken up by plastics, and provide economic benefits to Alaska. We can bring a new industry to our state. However, the precursor to seeing those benefits is passing HB 143. That concludes the presentation. We can either, if it's the will of the co-chair, we can either do the sectional analysis now or go to invited testimony.
Let's go to invited testimony and invite Adam Peer. He is the Senior Director of the American Chemistry Council. He's in Delaware, so that makes it about, after 8:30 p.m. there. So, Mr. Peer, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair. Appreciate you allowing me to be here. My name is Adam Peer, and I'm with the American Chemistry Council. And the ACC is a national trade association representing almost 200 global companies engaged in the chemical industry, including the leading manufacturers of plastic resins. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 143, which would appropriately regulate advanced recycling as manufacturing. And have a slight update for the folks is that should Alaska choose to move forward, it would be the 26th state. Just a day ago, Wyoming signed their advanced recycling bill into law. Increasingly, sustainability and reducing plastic waste is an extremely important part of our communities. This bill would establish an innovative way to drive our recycling rates up. To date, Alaska and much of the United States have been able to mechanically recycle things like soda and water bottles, milk jugs, detergent bottles, and some tubs and lids. However, it is challenging to mechanically recycle complex engineered packaging such as food pouches, snack wrappers, and yogurt tubs. Additionally, economics, market demand, and recent restrictions from China have been a major challenge. And this is really where the innovation comes in that Trevor just described. Instead of sending those valuable plastics to landfill or burning them for energy. Technologies like advanced recycling, commonly referred to as chemical recycling, can take these hard to recycle plastics and convert them into raw materials to produce new virgin equivalent plastics and chemical products. These are truly circular, environmental beneficial solutions that do not combust or burn the plastics material. And here are some examples of how the technologies have been successfully implemented in the United States. With Wendy's, Wendy's has switched from their paper-lined drink cups to an all-plastic cup made with 20% recycled plastics thanks to advanced recycling. Herbal Essence, one of the highest profile brands of Procter & Gamble, is producing 5 shampoo and conditioner bottles that are made from 50% certified recycled plastics. And companies like Warby Parker and Under Armour are bringing recycled materials into the eyewear industry via advanced recycling technologies. And as Trevor explained, if Alaska converted just 50% of the currently landfilled plastic feedstock in the state utilizing advanced recycling, it could generate over $70 million in economic output each year and up to 250 manufacturing jobs in Alaska. As manufacturing facilities, these technologies are also subject to state, federal, and local environmental regulations, including the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. It is important to note that now 25 states have passed similar laws to ensure that these technologies are regulated as manufacturing. Lastly, it's critical for advanced recycling companies looking to invest in the state that their technologies will be properly regulated as manufacturing and the products that they produce count as recycling towards future recycled content targets. HB 143 accomplishes these objectives and paves the way for Alaska to be a national leader in reducing plastic waste. In closing, I ask for support for HB 143 to help bring added investments and jobs to the state of Alaska while increasing recycling, conserving resources, and reducing plastic waste. With that, Chair, I thank you for your time today and be available to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Peer, especially at 8:30 p.m. on a Friday night. We do have some questions. I'll start with Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Peer, for your testimony. I think your testimony and the testimony or the description we heard from the bill sponsor, you know, I think I'm sufficiently convinced that this has an economic benefit and could be quite useful, and it's part of this, you know, broader economic effort for recycling. What I don't understand is sort of the necessity of this bill. That is to say, I don't really understand why this can't already be done. And what I'd like to hear from you specifically is sort of what's the practical difference for your members between regulating this as manufacturing versus using our existing regulations for recycling facilities? Like what actually changes for you if we categorize it that way versus regulating it as we do other facilities?
Mr. Peer?
Solid waste facilities.
Through the chair, good question. There's really sort of two areas that comes to bear. So it's really important that folks that want to make investments have the legal certainty of how their process is going to be regulated and how the content that they produce, the feedstock they produce, is going to be considered for meeting targets. And so one of the chief things that this does is it helps ensure that it provides the legal certainty for those investments. The second thing that it does is that it's really important to clarify, because a lot of times the terms like pyrolysis can be used in different parts of the statutes and have different applications and meaning. And again, I don't disagree with you that that a reasonable person could look at those statutes and come to the same conclusions that we do. But at the same time, if you're going to make those sorts of investments, you want to make sure that the technologies that you're bringing are going to be properly rated as manufacturing and not as a waste management process. The last part of your question about like what specifically is the difference, primarily it has to do with the standards that are in place for managing something that's as a waste management process versus meeting the compliance regulations for manufacturing. And there is a difference. And it's important, again, to have that legal certainty to know how something is going to be regulated.
Follow up, Senator Dunbar?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm still not quite understanding. So if you had legal certainty that you were going to be regulated as solid waste, I mean, it would still provide you legal certainty, right? So are you saying if you knew that you were going to be treated like other solid waste facilities with the same level of environmental requirements, does that mean that you would not open a plant here in Alaska? And sort of why? You know, why is legal certainty that you're solid waste? What's the practical difference from knowing that you're going to be regulated as a manufacturer?
Mr. Peer.
Through the chair, I think I'll have to follow up specifically on your question because I think you're asking for some specific details about the differences between the different regulatory schemes. I'd be happy to follow up and provide that to the committee. But to the larger point, the key difference is that this process is not a waste management process. It's a manufacturing process and should be regulated as such. But as to the specifics, I'd be happy to follow up with the committee to provide those specifics to you for your consideration.
Representative McKay, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I think I could maybe help a little bit in things that we learned through the chair, co-chair Giesel, to Senator Dunbar's question. What I learned in going through this exercise is there's actually 7 classes of plastic, and the traditional recycling techniques can handle 1 and 2. 3 through 7 are much more difficult to handle. They're more dense, they're more rugged, and so this process handles 3 through 7, and you need to have your regulations set up. The point is in the top bullet to have DEC set up the regulations as per this bill so that the emissions and the processes can be done safely in an environmentally sound manner. Couple things I learned that I think would be important to point out to the committee here today is a lot of plastic washes up on our shores because we have so much coastline. Despite our low population and rather small economy, a lot of plastic ends up here. The North Slope also generates a lot of plastic waste because of the huge industrial activity on the slope. So even though we have a very low population, we generate a lot of plastic in Alaska because of those reasons. We also have a lot of plastic in our lakes and our rivers. And what I wanted to point out was mentioned it in our presentation, but the demand for recycled plastic for packaging is growing by exponentially. So because of everyone's environmental consciousness in our society today, and I'm talking about the 330 million people that live in the lower 48, they want to buy products that are packaged using recycled plastic. That's what they want. So this process fills that niche so that that demand can be met. So that kind of helped me understand this whole idea. So I hope that's helpful.
Thank you, Representative McKay. I'll go to Senator Wilikowski for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this might be for Mr. Peer to start out with. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for staying up late on the East Coast to testify on this. And just getting back to the question from Senator Dunbar on what sort of changes, because my understanding is that this already can be done under existing law, and it just looking at the bill, it looks like it exempts in Section 4 this type of materials from the definition of solid waste. And if you go and look at the regulations on solid waste, you see, for example, 18 AAC 60010, it says a person may not store accumulated solid waste in a manner that causes health hazard, polluted runoff water, attraction of access of domestic animals, disease vectors, litter violation, et cetera, et cetera. Would those, and then if you go to 16 AAC 60009, it talks about using solid waste as an ingredient and says you got to protect the public health, safety, welfare. If we change the definition of solid waste, would it exempt these products from
those sort of regulations that we currently have in place?
Through the chair, I would say that the key difference is that we should be treating plastic that has been separated from the waste stream, not as waste, but feedstock. And so that's the key difference. And so in emphasizing that in statute, we're helping provide the legal certainty and the framework for advanced recyclers and make the investments to put in the equipment and infrastructure to then process those items through advanced recycling to create feedstock that can go into new products. I think it might help if I give a specific example of where, you know, clarity has been would be helpful. So, for example, in the state of New Jersey, which has recycled content requirements, it's one of two states that have them on general plastic products. The department there, in looking at the statutes and looking at the way pyrolysis was currently regarded, included that the output and the feedstock that came out of pyrolysis would not constitute recycled content. Now, certainly when we look at the statutes and we make our interpretation, we don't come to that same conclusion. However, if that issue would have been clarified before the General Assembly decided to do that, that would have helped provide the legal certainty around that issue. And so here what we're asking in this legislation is to provide those clarifications in advance of particularly how this process is going to be regarded under the statutes, so that it's clear where it's going to be regulated. Now, that being said, like any manufacturing process, it's still subject to, you know, federal and state law when it comes to making sure that the different elements are handled in an appropriate and safe manner and are not creating a nuisance or health hazards. But what we're seeking clarification for is that that's done in other places and not being treated as waste when it really is a manufacturing process. So that I think hopefully that example will help clarify why legal certainty and clarification is needed.
Senator Wilkowski, follow up.
Yeah, thank you. And I understand your desire for legal certainty, and I've always wondered why we don't have recycling for 3 through 7 plastics. I think we should. Would it provide legal certainty to you if we included relevant sections from, like, say, 18 AAC 60010? Would you support an amendment that said, for instance, a person may not store these products in a manner that would cause a health hazard or pollute runoff water? If we did an amendment like that, and at least then it would be in statute, you'd have some certainty, you knew what the law was. Would that alleviate your concerns, or would you support that amendment?
Mr. Peer?
Through the chair, certainly would consider, you know, language that would address your concerns, because certainly, we're not looking to create some sort of, exemption or alleviation from the duty to make sure that the process is, safe and respecting the environment, and certainly would be willing to consider and potentially work with your office to find mutually agreeable language that gets us, I think, to the same aims.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you through the chair to Mr. Peer. My question is around the energy intensiveness of this. Can you just speak a little bit to what the energy inputs are? And I think the idea is pretty attractive, but I'm just trying to fit this in with my understanding of our current energy constraints.
Mr. Peer?
Through the chair, the energy impact and the relevant emissions are about similar to, I'd say, an average size like college campus or hospital. So it's very similar to that. Of course, it depends on the size and the scope of the particular operations. But I think for context, the same energy and emissions output of about you know, decent-sized hospital or college campus would probably be a good example.
Follow-up, Senator Kaufman?
Thank you.
All right, Senator Klayman.
I'm looking, I know it's in the bill as well, but I'm looking at the last slide that the sponsor presented, and it talks about clarifying that plastic feedstock and products not be classified as industrial solid or other waste. And I suppose this is what creates this interesting challenge, because you've got somebody that has a bunch of plastics in their house or their business, they want to take them for recycling, and if they get them to the into the manufacturing stream, it seems like you want that to be treated as feedstock for manufacturing, but if they actually don't get it to the manufacturing site, it seems like that probably is still solid waste. And my question is, how do you deal with that dichotomy? On the one hand, you're trying to support recycling and get it into a manufacturing place, but a bunch of stuff isn't going to get into manufacturing, at least initially. And how are we to deal with that as a legal matter, because it certainly seems we have an interest in regulating the solid waste that doesn't get into the manufacturing stream. This is for Mr. Pierre.
Mr. Pierre.
Through the chair, excellent observation. And what I would draw your attention to is that the key difference is that when plastics or any other recyclable for that matter is separated from the waste stream, it's at that point that it's no longer considered waste, but it's considered recyclable that can be separated, baled, and processed either mechanically or through advanced recycling. And that would be the key difference, and would be very much happy to squint at that to find the relevant pieces of statute in this bill to illustrate that for the committee.
Follow up, Senator Klayman. This will be the last question.
Thank you. Then my last question is, it seems like it's a follow up on Senator Kaufman's, but I would like to see a little more detailed economic analysis, because what I've always understood about the advanced recycling is the notion that if you take the energy that's involved to transfer transfer recycled material and remake it into operational material to create new things, that if you take the energy to do that and the materials, you're actually using less energy overall than you would be to get oil out of the ground and start with raw material and create products. But in the bill presentation and other materials, I haven't really seen the analysis of that, and I'd be interested to see, and I know that's more complicated than what you can do in the time remaining, but I'd like to see a more detailed analysis that shows how this looks in the big picture, because the economic incentive to do this seems like, not that this is perfect recycling, if we all wore wool every day and didn't wear any plastic and didn't have anything plastic on our cars, it would be better for a recycling standpoint, but the reality is that there's still going to be plastic in the world, and this isn't the goal of this to me is to how do you actually reduce energy consumption and reduce the stuff that's coming out of the ground to create plastics and not get things put into landfills. But I think there needs to be some economic analysis to show how that works.
So thank you for that, Senator Klayman, and we'll make this request to Representative McKay to bring us back at the next hearing of the bill some more economic data. And you heard the question or the comments, so I'll let you do that. Do you have any brief closing remarks, Representative McKay?
Just a couple. Co-Chair Geisel, thank you, and to Senator Klayman. You know, if we don't, the materials that we don't recycle end up in a landfill. So that's not a good outcome. And we understand that Exxon just invested like $1 billion in a facility in Louisiana, so we may not realize it, but it's a pretty big business down in the lower 48. So thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and we'll get back to you with those answers. Thank you, guys. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Representative McKay. So we'll set this bill aside at this time. This concludes our meeting. Our next meeting is Monday, March 18th at 3:30 p.m. On the agenda, Senate Bill 168, Compensation for Wrongly Seized Game. And the second item will be a presentation on the microreactor pilot program at Eielson Air Force Base. At this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect, the time is 5 p.m.